Hi there, this is Catherine. Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of the Digital Marketing Victories podcast. Before we get into this month's episode, I just want to share with you the ways that you can support the podcast if you're finding the episodes helpful. You can send me a donation at buymeacoffee.com/DMVpodcast. Any and all level of donation would be very much appreciated. Help me offset the cost of producing the podcast. I'd also encourage you to subscribe to our newsletter so that you don't miss a future episode or any other news about the podcast. And to do that, you go to wostrategies.com/newsletter. Okay, on with our episode. Welcome to the Digital Marketing Victories podcast, a monthly show where we celebrate and learn from the change makers in digital marketing. I'm personally obsessed with how digital marketers sell through and get their ideas executed. I'm your host, Catherine Watsier-Ong. I'm the owner of WO Strategies, LLC. We focus on organic discovery for our enterprise clients with a training-centered approach. Hi there. Before we get into the episode, I'd love to remind you to subscribe to our podcast email list so that you don't miss any upcoming episodes. And once you're on our list, that would be the perfect way to give us feedback about the show or learn more about how you can support our efforts to educate digital marketers about the soft skills that they need to be successful. So you can join that list at t.ly/DMVpodcast. Okay, now on to the show. Today, we're joined by Helene Jelentz. Helene is an SEO specialist at Flow SEO with a strong background in anthropology and research. She got her start in content creation after leaving the US, kickstarting a career as a content strategist. And when she's not writing about the interplay of search and culture, you can find her wandering old European cities, vineyards, and food markets. Ugh. If I'm stuck here in the US, you sound delightful. This episode is going to be perfect for you if you're curious about how an anthropological approach to outreach, content, and persona creation could enhance your SEO work. So without further ado, here's our interview with Helene. Helene, thanks for agreeing to be on the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me. It's great.
So can you just give the listeners a little bit of background about you and how you became involved in digital marketing and the anthropology piece?
Sure. So I actually started studying anthropology in my undergrad at university. I started in music education, decided I could not teach children for the rest of my life. I didn't have that patience, and switched to anthropology, fell in love, went to grad school, got my master's in anthropology. And then I began traveling and creating content around travel. Started loving it, started learning SEO, started working for a few small brands until last year. I joined a remote agency called Flow SEO, where I work as a SEO specialist and manage a handful of clients.
Awesome. I'm kind of curious whether or not you can tell our listeners a little bit more about this anthropological perspective, because based on my Googling, it seems like I did not study anthropology in school. It seems like there's some key elements: holism, relativism, comparison, and field work. So you can kind of like explain all of those to our listeners and how that might impact your approach to SEO.
Sure. So anthropology is actually a bit different in the US versus outside of the US. It's studied a bit differently. So if you find someone who studied anthropology, say, in Europe, oftentimes they will either be archaeology or like cultural anthropology, and that's all they will study. Whereas in the US, there's a more holistic approach. So we study linguistic anthropology, biological, cultural, archaeology, and applied. So we have all of these fields that we use, and this contributes to the holism of, you know, my anthropological perspective is that I'm always thinking about those different aspects, you know, the biological aspect of being a human, how we speak, the words that we use and the cultural meanings behind them. You know, there's a lot of different things going on. So with that very diverse approach for anthropology, it can add a layer of depth to your perspective, your research. And relativism, cultural relativism is a really, really important concept for anthropology. And the best way for me to describe this to non-anthropologists is not to be comparative in a way. You know, put yourself in someone else's shoes. It may seem really bizarre at first when you hear something that is completely different from what you do. But if you just take a moment and realize that maybe that culture or that person just came from a completely different set of circumstances, have a different set of values, and that you should be understanding that culture or those behaviors on the basis of that, you know, historical, political, cultural aspects. And I think that that's really, really helpful. And combining that with, you know, the field work, doing really deep, long studies, integrating yourself into new communities, really getting to know people, your target audience, whoever they may be. I really enjoy doing sets of interviews that are not just one-off, because I think it's really hard to get deep, meaningful information from people by just meeting them once and just speaking to them once. They're not going to share all the good stuff with you the first time.
Interesting. So the U.S. approach is all of those pieces of anthropology. So a holism mm-hmm. sort of background. But I think you mentioned that. So, and the applied anthropology mostly is taking all of those, the research from the different approaches and just applying it to your work. Is that really what the definition is, or is there more there?
Nope, that's it.
That's basically it. Okay.
Yes. Old school anthropology. I mean, maybe you're familiar, you know, with the classics, Margaret Mead going to Samoa and interviewing young women about, you know, their sexuality and coming of age and these processes. These were very old ethnographies. They didn't really have an application to them. They were more of just gathering information. So there was a shift in the field where people then started doing more international development, community development, policy, nonprofit work. And then that is where that applied aspect came into it.
That makes sense to me. So how does this impact how you in particular create surveys or questions to get to know that target audience? Do you do something different than the rest of us do?
Probably.
Are you going to tell us any of your secrets?
Yes, yes. I've actually studied interviewing at so much depth, and I've had a lot of experience. I've had a lot of incredible mentors, and I'm very, very thoughtful about the kind of questions that I'm asking. I wouldn't, you know, leading questions is one of my biggest pet peeves in the entire world. As soon as I read a study, I go immediately to the methodology. I check what questions they're asking. And then I make my own assessments about how that research went. But I really think about that, like preparing what you're going to do with those answers and how you're going to process that data before you even ask it. I think this is the main aspect for people. They want to ask questions. You get in an interview. Of course, you want to ask lots of things. You're interested. You're like, I just want to know. But should you really be asking them that? Like, is that valuable data? Yeah, you're interested. But what are you going to do with that afterwards? Like, were you just taking something from them, you know, that was not valuable to your research? So I think considering this, exactly the questions that you're going to ask, thinking about how someone would feel if they were asked those questions, think about the order of them. Think about how you think about, you know, the topic that you're asking about, and really try to understand that there's a human on the other side of that. And they have, you know, a bad day, a good day. They have things that happen. And some topics may need a bit more sensitivity to them. And that, like, is definitely something that has to be prepped ahead of time. So I think a lot of people think, okay, interviewing's easy. I can just ask these questions. That'll be interesting information. That's great if you're just getting a quote. But if you actually want to do something with that data, then you do need to plan it out strategically. Like, what are you going to do with that information once you get it?
So do you have like a little cheat sheet for figuring out whether or not it's a leading question? I was connecting it to, you know, I studied analytics with Avinash Kaushik. And so he has this, but why, you know, you ask that three times in a row to really figure out if it's an insight or not, or whether you're just stating data for the sense of stating data. So do you have something like that so people can sort of check themselves about whether or not a question is a leading question or not?
I never thought about creating a resource like this, or I don't know if I've ever seen one. So maybe this is something I need to think about creating this year.
Maybe I'll have to follow back up with you. I think it's a valuable thing to have. There's got to be some way for you to just check yourself in each question, but It's beyond what I could come up with. So anyway, if you come up with something, let me know. I will add it to the show notes. So can you give us an example of a successful marketing campaign that you were involved in that was impacted by your anthropological approach?
Sure.
Can you think of one?
Yeah, I mean, everything I do has my anthropological approach connected to it. There's no way to separate it from myself. It's just who I am at this point. Mm. But yeah, sorry. I just like spaced out for a second.
So do you have a campaign in particular that you thought was pretty successful? Where you, you know, either dug around on social or did some interviews? We can come back to it too.
And sharing those things with me, sharing what it was like working before that software and then after that software, and hearing them speak and using their own words that they use daily, that was really helpful. Those pages are still doing incredible, really like over a 3% click-through rate. Yeah, they're still the top pages on that site to this day.
Yeah, that sort of reminds me when I was working on healthit.gov, we had something similar because one of our target audiences was physicians, of which I am not one. And I just felt like I really pushed the team because I was like, I think we need to do focus groups with them because I don't know what, how long it should be, what language we should use, like all, I don't know what goes on in their head. You know, like, do they research answers on a tablet or their phone or the desktop? I have no idea. Anyway, it was super insightful. The summary was they're very busy and they really needed bullet points. Really. So, I mean, I guess maybe you could have guessed some of that, but, oh, and the other, actually the other insightful part was that, they might not even read what we were putting out. It was like their assistant, which is good information to know too. Anyway. So I kind of wonder, does your educational background give you some, really strong listening skills that maybe the rest of us could learn a bit from? Cause for instance, if listeners of the show are curious about listening skills, you should listen to Dana Theus's episode 19 because she talks about this. And I'm always looking to increase my own listening skills. But so for how about for you? Do you think you got some more skills related to that because of your educational background? Any tips?
Yeah, definitely. It really is about practicing active listening and note-taking. These are two of my biggest like suggestions for anyone who wants to get into interviewing and to improve, besides practice, because really it's just practice. It's getting comfortable with having an intimate moment with someone that you may not know, and really having a deep conversation. And that could be really difficult. So it's just about leaving yourself at the door, being open-minded, leaving judgment away. You are just there to collect information, maybe reflect a little bit, clarify. It's all about active listening, and having those notes. Even I tell people, take notes before just to set sort of an intention, a mindfulness. How do you feel? Are you nervous about going in? Write about it. Then when you're done, take about 20 minutes or so, 15 minutes, and write the notes on how you felt afterwards. Anything you might have observed as well. Like, did they look nervous? Were they excited? When did they get, like, what, did they smile when they talked about certain things? So like these notes can be really, really helpful for just remembering those small moments that can make your content more human.
Do you think there's a like correct way of taking notes? Like, should it be a pen and paper? Voice notes, typing, does it matter?
If you're doing an interview, I say always audio record because you will not remember everything. And if you're writing the whole time, you're not active listening. You just aren't. So I would use my notes as like a pen and paper if I'm doing a person in person, and maybe just a few words, but I wouldn't try to write out sentences and stuff. That's the point of me recording. Of course, you have to get their permission, but having that, so you can go back, you will forget things. Like, you will lose things. There's so much information in an interview. So I highly recommend recording. If you're doing it, you know, over Zoom or something, you can easily type up some notes while you're there, and not be distracting. But that's the main thing, just not distracting the person while they're speaking, and just giving them that space to share their stories.
Great. That's like a super helpful tip. So I'm kind of curious. I know in our previous conversation, we talked a bit about how you're using social media. Particularly, I was curious about how you're using that to come up with some content ideas or personas. And then I'm also curious whether or not you take into account the culture of each platform as a piece of the environment when you're taking notes. And I bring this up because if you've been a listener of the show, hopefully you've listened to episode 2 with Joe Federer, where he talks about the different psychology of the different social networks. Like, for instance, I'll give you an easy one. So Reddit is anonymous. So the vibe there is different because everybody's anonymous. And Facebook is mostly your friends and family. So that might impact kind of how you interact on that platform. So anyway, I was just kind of wondering if you can, what was your thought on how you observe in social? How do you use it? And do you think your insights are impacted by the culture of the platform?
Yeah, there's definitely a completely different culture on every platform. I mean, even if you're comparing, you know, Facebook to your website, and or how someone uses search or social, the kinds of topics that you're probably going to talk about, maybe even the comments, they can definitely vary. Yeah, as you're saying, is your real name attached to it? Does your mom see it or does nobody see it? So one thing I actually is my favorite, which probably goes against every single bit of advice you get on the internet. I read comments all the time. I just read them. I take it with a grain of salt. I know that anyone could be writing anything. I know that there's bots. But after a while, you're able to figure out, you know, what is going on here? What is the general attitude? And you can kind of pick it out, you know, like it's easy once you've done it for so long. I started this strategy years ago. I think when I was in grad school, there used to be comments. I think it was on the New York Times article. They have since removed comments from all news articles, but they used to be quite fascinating. And there was this article about the use of welfare in the US. And that was a really big topic of research for me about how people are using resources. And the comments were devastating, absolutely devastating. Mm. And I did an entire research paper on this and was sharing this lecture around at university. And it made me realize, like, people really feel anonymous. Like, sometimes people are really sharing what they feel. And definitely, like, locating those spaces and understanding, you know, the kind of tone that they're using. So maybe if someone was writing on Facebook, yeah, they're going to be a little bit more safe for work. Whereas on Reddit, you can have a lot of not safe for work content there, but it might be really valuable. It doesn't mean you have to replicate it, but you learn a lot about the language that's being used, the values, the culture. It can be quite fascinating. So I always go to the comments.
So it sounds like you're hearing, so I heard culture and values and maybe emotion. So it sounds like you use some of that for your persona work, maybe?
Yeah.
How do you apply it to SEO? That was the second part of the question.
Sure. For example, a client that I am working with was using a very specific set of keywords for their product. But then I realized because they had switched to a different industry from tech to like creators, that creators were using a much different language than enterprise tech companies. So that changes the keywords, that changes the content, that changes the language. One of my favorite examples that I talk about a lot is if you compare MailChimp with ConvertKit's blog, they have the same offering product-wise, but they have completely different audience. So they have completely different topics there. So yeah, just getting in there, understanding the language that they're using and how they would use that on search, you know, if they're going to write it on TikTok or if they're going to write it on Twitter in that way, they're probably searching it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. So this reminds me, I have one, I guess I stumbled into anthropology once on one campaign. We had one campaign for this pharma company and the drug was for people that have a condition called, oh, now I'm going to forget the name, of course, but the layman's term was claw hand because your hand gets crimpled like a claw. But you're not allowed to use that term, it turns out, because they're FDA regulated. But we were trying to just get to the audience and figure out like, what are their challenges? What are their struggles? So we could write content that would resonate with them. I mean, for, you know, partially for link building, but then also just to understand who we're talking about. And once we used the non-FDA term, of course, and started getting onto social forums, it was kind of amazing because we discovered that a lot of them, I mean, this is not all of them, but a lot of them were very upset about figuring out how to play guitar and banjo because of the hands getting crumpled. And a number of them were Harley Davidson riders and needed unique gloves for it. And anyway, it was just really insightful. You're like, wow. And of course, the client had no idea about any of this. We're like, and we were planning a live event. So we're like, okay, maybe we'll do some stuff with the motorcycle. And, you know, it just gives you all these ideas around how to interact with the target audience that you wouldn't have gotten from the client, all because of social.
Yeah. And it's a very human and fun, you know, it puts a fun twist to a very like sad topic.
Yes, definitely. Cause we were stuck mentally. We're like, what are we doing with this? You know, all we're getting is like, I'm so sorry, your hand is becoming dysfunctional. Right. So how do you spin on that and connect with them anyway? So social was interesting in that one instance. Here you are on, learning about your target audience, potentially using social for it, but how do you identify and address any biases that might come up that might impact your marketing campaign? So your bias applied to a target audience. I'm kind of wondering if you have like a way to check yourself before marketing campaigns become approved.
Yeah. I don't know if I exactly have something to offer others. I guess this is something I really have to think about creating content from. It's one of those things that you do so much that it's second nature.
Yeah. But I don't think it's second nature for everyone. That's why
no, it's not. And I don't realize this. So yeah. I never thought about even writing about these topics. So these are great questions. I really believe in the leaving yourself at the door, sort of like try not to bring your personal feelings into it. Of course, sometimes I'll get excited. I think about things that people would want to read or engage with, but I'm mainly thinking about that client. I kind of humanize them of like, if this was someone I cared about, you know, how would I help them at work, especially working in a B2B space? You know, I try to imagine my family members at work. How would I help them? Like, how would I approach this? And sometimes I probably missed the mark. I started working with a client in Australia. I've never been to Australia. There's a slightly different culture. There's different language that we have to use. But I use my experiences because their industry is working with the trades. A lot of my family members in the US worked in the trades. They had their own businesses. So a lot of those very human day-to-day experiences I sort of had. And then I take the opportunity to ask my clients questions. We meet, you know, twice a month. And sometimes I'll throw in a few questions. I'll ask them about what they've been up to lately, about their clients. Just ask them, you know, day to day, understanding the local holidays or culture, these things. It's just that human touch to everything that really makes a difference.
Yeah, because I think if folks haven't, so my undergrad had a third world development requirement. So you had to do something related to that before you could finish graduating. So even though you're not traveling, you're deep diving into some third world culture. So I think that plus some travel helped me sort of realize that it's not the same everywhere. Right? Yeah. But if you don't have that experience or you don't get a chance to travel, I think it would be really hard. Like, I think I shared with you talking about Australia. Like when we went on my honeymoon to Australia, they're English speaking. I mean, I knew they had a different culture, but I was pretty floored by the radically different terms that are being used for stuff. Like, I forget what it was, but I think it was like renting an apartment. Yes. What was the term again?
Letting.
Right. There's no way I would have guessed letting. There's just no way.
Yeah.
There were a couple like that where you're like, wow, that's radically different, even though we all speak the same language in theory, right? Mm-hmm. But it's just radically different. Anyway, so if you have a resource about how to check your assumptions or biases for a campaign, I think it'd be helpful for the industry. So have you ever launched any like formal user testing or used user testing tools, or are you normally doing face-to-face one-on-one interviews?
usually face-to-face, one-on-one interviews. I haven't done anything much larger. It's quite hard to get a budget for research in SEO, in marketing. Yeah. I've had a handful of agencies reach out that they wanted, you know, will you sign on so we can do someone, like have someone to do research? But then the clients never want to pay for the part of research. So then I'm the first part that gets cut. Which is a bit unfortunate. I think there's a lot of value in creating your own research and having your own original data to work from. But yeah, I haven't had the opportunity to work with like some of the larger tools out there, or larger case studies.
You certainly need to have a budget for some of those for sure. So I am also sort of curious. So I'm familiar with the jobs to be done framework. And I know the industry talked about it a little bit, about how you walk through a persona and their pain point and challenge and what they actually need to get done on your website, along with whatever emotions might be involved in that. Have you ever applied that framework to what you're doing?
So to be honest, I had never heard of this.
Oh, well, there you go.
I looked it up and I was like, huh. Well, this is already what I'm doing. I just didn't know there was a name for it.
Now you know the name.
This is part of the reason I think I love B2B. I think it's much easier to really understand what people need and what people want, how it's going to help them, and understanding, you know, how can your tool solve a problem or how can it make their work experience better or whatever it may be. I think it's very straightforward and I really appreciate that. And I'm always like breaking down things to the very core of, you know, what exactly are they struggling with or what exactly do they love about your product? Like let's boost that.
Yeah. And do you say that because you work more in B2B than B2C?
Do I say what?
Oh, that it's easy to do in B2B. That's mostly because your experience is B2B, not because it's not possible to apply the framework to B2C, right?
No, I think it's possible. It's just that B2C, I think, can be very difficult. There's a lot of emotional components. Not saying it's not in B2B, certainly is. But I think there's a lot more culture and emotion that goes into consumer behavior, you know, in a B2C environment. Sometimes I buy things and I cannot tell you why I bought them. That's normal,
right? So,
you know?
Yeah.
That's not going to make a marketer happy, but it's the truth.
I'm really surprised. And again, maybe this is just because I was, curious and I have a little bit of a UX background, but I was really surprised how many people didn't know that strong emotions can literally impact how you interact with search and web pages. You know, like if you're angry, you actually see less, you're able to absorb less. Like it's just fascinating to me how different strong emotions can impact how you're reading online and what you see and what you select. And if you're in an industry where that's part of your challenge, because I do a lot of stuff in health, right? So if that's your challenge, that people who come to you are in an emotional moment with a strong emotion, you should take that into account when you're creating the content. If it's overly complex, they might not literally be able to read it because they have so much emotion sort of clouding their judgment, right? They talk about that, but literally will kind of cloud their vision, not be able to see all of it. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Do you have a primer book or resources on anthropology that you'd recommend to somebody if they want to learn more?
Sure. So it's a very dense topic. So I would suggest going straight into an ethnography. They're usually relatively short books that deep dive into a specific topic. So why I say an ethnography is because of the research skills required to do field work are very intense. That's usually spending a long time with a group, learning the language, learning the culture, and doing a very specific study. So they know exactly what they're doing. It's very parallel to, you know, a marketing strategy. You know exactly who you're going for. You know exactly what you want. and that will be, you know, very helpful to see how to do a very big deep dive and all the different aspects of a human, you know, of the human experience that can influence our decision making. So there is, it's an old classic called Dancing Skeletons, Life and Death in West Africa, by Catherine Detweiler. And I remember reading this book and just breaking down at one point and crying because it was just so heavy of realizing how different the world can be and my position in that and my privilege in that as well. And I just, it really was one of those things to really like give you a stark contrast. There's a lot of really great ethnographies that have come out in the last few years. If you just go to like Anthropology News, there's like the American Anthropological Association. They have a lot of great things that they share, essays on different topics. Yeah. Or another one, which I'm going to throw in because I love it for people who want a heavier read, is The First 500 Years of Debt, The First 500 Years by David Graeber. Rest in peace. He is an idol of mine in a academic sense. Great, really great insights and criticisms of systems. And he was, yeah. So I think if you want something a bit more modern, on a modern take, go that way. If you want a classic, go with The Dancing Skeletons.
You know, as you were speaking, I was thinking about how we've had folks on the show talking about empathy. As you know, the more empathetic you can be towards your client or your target audience, the more successful you can be. But I've always been sort of digging into like, okay, but how do you get the empathy? How do people build empathy? And I'm just sort of struck by how your approach probably helps you get there, because you're understanding the tone and the emotion mm-hmm. and the environment somebody's in and their background that might impact what they're doing, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, do you agree?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I'm very rare to put myself first, I think. It's like a curse and a blessing, but it definitely helps me in my work by realizing, you know, there's a lot of other experiences out there. And if you're not excited about learning about your target audience, if you don't care about them, you're probably in the wrong niche or industry. So, I mean, you should be excited for them. I mean, I've never worked with somebody that I didn't like, you know. I've been fortunate in that sense. But yeah, if you are not interested in your target audience, then you're in the wrong spot.
Totally agree. This is why I say no to projects sometimes, because I'm like, oh dear God, I don't care. Yep. If I don't care, then I'm probably not going to be very good at creating a marketing plan for you.
Exactly.
Yeah. Because yeah, there's a couple. I sit here in DC, there's a lot of politics and lobbyists and stuff. So there's a few things that I just don't care about. So anyway, talking about this empathy, because I know, I think it was a previous episode, actually talked about empathy is this essential tool to building relationships, more thinking about like interacting with your coworkers and your clients and folks you work with. But how do you think that your approach, so the anthropology approach, could help build empathy both for like target audience stuff, like marketing campaign, my target audience, but then also your team? Like, can you apply it to your coworkers and your clients?
Yep. I think it's really, really important. I don't know if you had this feeling when you were in, you know, school, especially university. It felt like every teacher or professor forgot that you were enrolled full time, that you had other classes. They would assign work and you're like, you do know I have 5 other finals like next week on top of yours. What are you doing? I think that they've lost sight of how hard it can be. And I try to remember this at work. You know, I work with a lot of large enterprise companies now. They're busy. My husband works in a massive corporation. He's in meetings 8 hours a day. So I totally get that. And I understand that they don't always have the mental capacity to care about what I'm doing or to engage in what I'm doing. So I always try to consider that I'm there as the consultant to take things off their plate. I'm there to help them, not add to their load. And just being mindful that like, yeah, sometimes people have a bad day. Like don't get obsessed over, you know, someone might've made a weird comment one day or something. It's we're all human. Like really, it's just that it's very simple.
Yeah, I find it very fascinating in my own experience that, you know, I was like the go-getter in my 20s, single, and had a particular perspective. And it shifted a lot once I got a dog, weirdly. Shifted a lot once I got married. Shifted a lot once I had kids. And then you understand how, like, trying to function being sleep deprived. Yeah. The level of empathy for other people making mistakes. You're like, well, maybe their baby didn't sleep last night, you know, but yeah. I didn't have that perspective when I was in my 20s because people don't tell you what kids are really like. So like, it's not until you have them that you realize what they're really like. But anyway, it's just very fascinating how, yeah, that would be your own life experience. And us not digging enough into what it's really like for other people. So do you have a format that you possibly use? I mean, I know you instinctively do this, but if other people wanted to create a formula for this and apply this approach to their coworkers and clients, other than I'm sure they had a rough day. Because again, like my brain wasn't there until I had the kids. And I think that's common, only because I interact with people without kids and they don't seem to come see what I'm coming from, right? So do you have an approach that you can apply? So you're like, yeah, can but be on their shoes a bit more?
Yeah, I think it's mindfulness and having, you know, intention, being intentional. Thinking before you speak, you know, we're very quick to just react. I used to be very quick to react to lots of things, and I realized that sometimes I didn't come across the way that I wanted to. Maybe you misread an email. And you just blow up because you're having, you know, whatever day. You can really damage a relationship that way. And now, if I know I'm not in a good headspace, I won't respond unless, you know, it's 100% necessary. But if I have to take, you know, a couple hours or wait 12 hours, 24 hours, then I will respond to something. But I also, you know, try to have patience. It's not easy. It isn't. But like I said, I know that my colleagues are great. They'll support me whenever they can. But yeah, I also know some of them have children. I don't. And I know that that is a massive challenge for them. They have a completely different schedule and they're getting sick constantly. Mm-hmm. So I know then that I don't have children. I have a little bit more freedom in my schedule. So sometimes I try to help them out a bit more. You know, I understand that it's hard and they're not my children, but it's okay. Cause like we're all human in the world. And I know that's anthropology, but it is, it's about the human experience. It's about really just taking that moment and seeing that we're all here trying to do our best.
Yeah. I always kind of wondered whether or not you could, like, I don't know, shadow one of your clients or something. I was very shocked by that when I was at Ketchum, cause the younger PR people went from school to PR and they had never been in-house. And so as you were talking about, hey, my client might be busy and I'm not the only thing that's involved in their world. That was the part that always drove me crazy because they would just bug their clients all the time. And I'm like, I used to be in-house. I'd have the multiple consultants and I'm like, they're probably in meetings. They're probably busy. But me telling them that is not as impactful. I was, anyway, just was always curious, like, is there a better way for them to learn this?
Just take a nice screenshot of their calendar.
Right.
Or just like make them go through it for 1 week, just like all day meetings, and then say, how do you feel?
Yeah, maybe that's it. I think that's actually something I ask my clients now, actually, now that you talk about it, is kind of asking a little bit about what their calendar is like, what their day is like, is like a get to know you icebreaker moment, just get a feel. Yeah. Anyway, so this has been great. Is there anything else you want to share? Otherwise, I've got some standard questions I usually ask everybody.
No, I don't think so. Okay. I don't know. It was just great to talk about all that stuff.
I think it's obviously I gave you a couple content ideas. I've got all sorts of questions for your approach. So have you had an aha moment recently with your client's target audience or your target audience for your business for where you work now?
An aha about the target audience. I think it's just kind of similar to what I was mentioning before about also dealing with clients is that mental availability. The B2B, I mean, they're probably not thinking about buying your software while they're home, feeding their children. And that's what they're thinking about at work. When they're told, like, come on, let's get this going. We need to get the contract. Yeah, it's understanding the mental availability, because I think years ago I would be like, you know, just bash out that work, bash out that marketing, put up all those posts. But especially in that B2B space, I'm mindful about like not oversaturating that and that they don't have time to read all this stuff. They're at work. You're just trying to help them along with their work. You're not trying to give them more work. So that's definitely something that's
I love that. You're not trying to give them more work.
Yeah.
That should be like a checklist item when you finish a piece of content. Did I just give somebody more work?
Yep.
Do you have any recent wins or resources that you want to share with our audience today?
I actually have an article I wrote on B2B writing pitfalls and some real world examples for Flow SEO, which I shared the link with you. And this has been a really great article slash turned into a educational session that we give clients now to teach them about, you know, B2B SEO writing. And I also did a piece for Search Engine Journal around interviewing for niche B2B industries. So I think if anyone is interested in learning about interviewing and some tips on how to prepare for that, that article is a great place to start.
Great. Those are awesome. I'll put them in the show notes. And so how can people learn more about you?
You can find me pretty much everywhere, but LinkedIn, Helene Yelens, wanderinghelene.com is a travel blog. If you want to see a little bit of what I was up to pre-pandemic, definitely need to revitalize it a bit. So yeah.
Awesome. This has been great. Thanks for sharing all of your tips. And do let me know if you create additional resources. I'll add them to the show notes.
Thank you. That's great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks. Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the podcast and what we're up to, go to digitalmarketingvictories.com. And if you like what you heard, subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us, comment, and share the podcast, please. I'm always looking for new ideas, topics, and guests. Email us at digitalmarketingvictories@gmail.com or DM us on Twitter @DMVictories. Thanks for listening.